It's also a village, and it's a village and it has been.
Hello and welcome in.
Science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello. So humans have used tools for much of our history, to the point where tools may even have contributed to the evolution of our species itself. Much of what we know about tools used by early hominids can be learnt from the geological record by looking at artifacts and studying the tools that our ancestors used. But we can also learn a lot by looking at non-human primates and how they use tools. Thomas Proffitt is a researcher at Oxford and part of the Primate Archaeology Group. Right now he looks at tools used by chimpanzees, capuchins and macaques, and this gives us insights into how primates fashion tools and how the tools have shaped us. Hello, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
Hi. So later, Thomas is actually going to be showing us how to make some stone tools. So if you can, try and get hold of what kind of rocks are we looking for, Tom?
It's flint, and it's very sharp, so if you find it, be very quite careful with it.
Yeah, so if you know flint, it's kind of like a dark, sharp-looking, angular rock.
It is. It's a really homogeneous rock with very few impurities in it, and it's incredibly sharp.
Cool. So that's why it's useful for tools. So we're going to be looking at that later. But first off, we've got a bit of a brain teaser to get started. A tool many of us use every day. I have keys, but no locks. I have a space, but no room. You can enter, but can't go outside. What am I? So if you know the answer to that, why don't you tweet in to at Soho Radio or Science Mixtape, and we'll try and get some answers, see if anyone can guess what's going on. So first off, we're going to ask Thomas, what is a tool?
Basically, I think at the very basic level, a tool is an object. It could be a natural object or an object that's been made, but has been worked on or is used to work on something else. So at a very basic level, you can take a stone and hit something with it. The stone you're holding in your hand then ceases to be just a stone. It then becomes a tool.
Okay, so it can start something as basic as just a stone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so how did these stones, you know, change over time? I mean, and when did they come into existence for humans?
So up until last year, we thought that the earliest stone tools were about 2.6 million years old. And then last year they found a site in Kenya, in a place called West Turkana, which is a huge lake, and it's one of the richest Paleolithic archaeological sites in the world. And they found stone tools which are relatively different to anything that we know about or have seen before, and they're dated to 700,000 years earlier, so that's 3.3 million years old.
Wow, so that's really, really a long time ago.
Very long time ago, yeah. Really difficult to get your head around those kind of periods of time.
That's amazing. So And these were found in Kenya. Was this when, like, humans were in that area? Or are we talking about pre-human-human?
So, yeah, exactly. The earliest stone tools, so the 3.3, are around before any of the evidence that we have for our genus, so the genus Homo. There are hominins, which are upright bipedal apes, basically, but they're in the genus Australopithecus. So these are pre-human upright walking apes, basically.
So these are kind of like us, but not quite us yet.
Yeah, kind of like us. They're a lot smaller. They don't have our body proportions, and they have a much smaller brain size. But yeah, exactly. They're on the hominin lineage.
Oh, that's amazing. So we're going to start off. We're going to have your first song. So could you tell us what it is and why you chose it?
It's a song from my teenage years, I think. It was one of my favourite bands when I was growing up in Wales, and it's a song by Blind Melon. I think they had one good song that everyone seems to know about, but this is one of the songs that is on one of their albums and is a good song but never really got much coverage.
Cool, so this is Blind Melon with Mouthful of Cavities.
And your soul's a bowl of jokes. And every day you remind me how I'm desperately in need.
The oldest tools ever discovered were found in Kenya and date back to 3.3 million years ago, predating the earliest humans.
Yeah, thanks, Matilda. So that's what we were talking about right before, Thomas. So this is 3 million years ago when humans weren't really humans yet. But what kind of tools were they making back then? What's the kind of things that you find?
So the very earliest ones are from a site called Lomekwe, technically Lomekwe 3. And these are huge river cobbles, basically, that have been both pounded and what's called flaked. And so they've been struck with a hammerstone, and from them have detached quite large flakes with sharp, really sharp cutting edges.
And this is this kind of flinty stone that you're talking about? Or
yeah, so in East Africa, you get less flint. So flint is only really kind of a European thing, stone. In East Africa, you get lava, you get basalts, and you get quartzites and various metamorphic stones.
Okay, and these are all quite fine textured stones.
Yeah,
they look like a uniform colour.
Yeah, absolutely. They're all pretty homogenous, and that's one of the prerequisites for being able to make stone tools, is they need to be a homogeneous material. So you can't make it from granite, for instance. So granite's too hard and too unhomogeneous. But
cool. And you've actually got some samples here.
I have.
What do you have? Could you describe to us what you've brought? So Thomas has brought a couple of very old samples, and you said over a million years.
Yes, I have two pieces from East Africa, which are as a lava cobble, which has been very crudely flaked, and these are pieces that would be classified as Olderwan technology. So this is now, up until last year, we thought it was the first technology. It's now the second technology, and this technology spanned for a million years, and it was unchanged for a million years. So it is a very simple technology where you have a cobble, and you take a hammerstone, and you strike the cobble, and off from the cobble comes a flake with a sharp edge. So I have a cobble with a couple of flake removals, and I have one of the flakes as well.
Okay, so this flake is probably, I don't know, it's maybe 3 or 4 centimeters across, and it one of the edges is kind of been chipped, so it looks like it's quite sharp. It's actually made for cutting.
Absolutely. So one of the features of the older one is that the flakes are quite small. They're 5 centimeters, 6 centimeters at the maximum, and they have these incredibly sharp edges, and that's just a consequence of the mechanics of producing them. It's not it's an intentional consequence. But it's a reason. It's just a mechanical basis for how they're made.
So they were just made by striking a stone, and off comes a flake, and then that becomes a useful tool.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the whole process of what we call napping, which is the process of producing these flakes from stone, requires quite a sophisticated understanding of angles and of fracture mechanics. The hominins might not have been thinking about the angles and fracture mechanics, but they understood that if you struck a stone at a certain angle, you would get a flake, reliably get flakes detached from these stones.
And so about this time, what were the humans looking like? Were people wearing clothes? Was this like, you know...
No. So these were, with the older one anyway, at least, you have associated with that a hominin called Homo habilis, which is quite a small upright standing hominin with a relatively small brain size. It's bigger than the hominins that preceded it, but it's much smaller than Homo erectus, which is the one that everyone kind of at least
has heard
about,
of.
So these were not particularly large hominins. They were walking around a savanna environment, and they weren't at the top of the food chain. They were competing with various large predators, and so the fact that they could make these tools allowed them to get access to meats and carcasses that other animals couldn't get access to, basically.
So this was predominantly just a way of, you know, helping them survive and feed themselves.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was a way of getting hold of the meat that would allow them to kind of continue to survive, and it was a high-protein source of energy.
So these actual artifacts, where did you get this specific one that we're
looking at now? So these ones are from an area in northeast Tanzania called Olduvai Gorge, and these are, I have to make certain that these are out of context. These are not archaeologically excavated, so this is surface material from out of context. They're good examples, or relatively good examples, not the best examples, but relatively good examples of this very simple flake stone technology.
And so the area you've been working in has been been worked for a few years. This is
absolutely so. Olduvai is one of the best known archaeological sites, paleoanthropological sites in the world, and it was excavated by Lewis and Mary Leakey from like the 50s onwards, and became the site where you have the first instance of the deep antiquity of the human species. So you have big first discoveries of paleoanthropological fossil hominins. So you have Australopithecus sedentopus, Homo habilis, and this is where the older one comes from. It's where the type site from the older one. So it was one of these really important archaeological sites.
So, you're saying that there's not just tools, but there are also other archaeological digs there from actually remains of...
Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge number of hominin fossils from there. There's an even larger number of just fossils in general, in terms of various animal species. And then you have the archaeological material, you have the tools and everything. So yeah, it's a really fruitful area in East Africa.
That's amazing. So you're actually gonna help us make some of these stone tools. we're gonna try and recreate some of these amazing million-year-old tools that we have here. But first, we're gonna have your second song. So if you could just introduce that, please.
So this is a song called The Mother by Xavier Rudd. And Xavier Rudd, I think, was probably the most expensive album I ever bought. I think it was about £25.
Oh, wow.
But it's fantastic, and his early songs are really mellow and good. And he plays all the instruments at the same time, basically. He has this, you see him live, he has this big contraption around him where he has didgeridoos and keyboards and guitars and all sorts of things. It's great.
Cool. So this is Xavier Rudd with The Mother.
Do you feel it in the sunshine? Do you feel it in the rain? Do you feel it in the ocean when the waves are clean? Do you feel it in the evenings when the moon is up? Feel it in your bones when she fills you up. Oh yeah, yeah, she breathes good luck. Mother Earth, Mother Earth.
Flint naturally breaks into sharp-edged pieces, a process known as conchoidal fracturing. Early people recognised this property and learned to fashion it into knife blades, spear points, and other sharp tools using a method known as flint knapping.
Flint knapping, right? So we're going to have a go at it ourselves.
A bit of a demonstration.
What we've got here is we've got a couple of rather large pieces of flint. They're probably about the size of your fist or slightly bigger.
Yep.
And then you've also got these kind of rounded pebble-like. What's this?
Yeah. So these are quartzite river cobbles. Basically, they're just a hard, rounded cobble that you would find in any large river, basically.
Okay, so and that's just been like nice and smooth by the flow of the water.
Yeah, and you need this nice round, smooth surface, or at least a rounded surface, so that when you direct the force into the flint, it's only directed at one specific point. If you had a really kind of undulating and awkward shaped stone, the force would be directed at several points, and you wouldn't really get any outcomes at all.
Brilliant. So, take it away. Let's have a go.
I'm not sure how good this is going to sound on.
No. On the radio. This is great. So Tom's just kind of turning over. He seems to be picking.
Basically, what you're looking for all the time is that there's an angle of less than 90 degrees. If you strike the flint core, the large block of flint, at an angle of greater than 90 degrees, nothing happens. The conchoidal fracture, the mechanism for making these flakes, can't start, basically. So right. It has to be less than 90 degrees. And so what you're looking for is this angle, and I've, knowing that I was going to bring these on, I found pieces that actually have these angles on them already. So hopefully, there's always a bit of error potentially in this, but we'll see what we can do.
And you've got some bits of material here as well. Is that you're going to use now? Or?
the material on the floor.
These little square pieces, are these?
Oh no, those are basically that. Because you can flint knap either just by holding it on your hand, or you can flint knap by putting it on your leg.
Okay.
When you put it on your leg, because these things are really sharp, they slice through your clothes, and then they slice through your leg. And
that's
really
less
painful.
Than ideal.
No. So those are just leather.
Not
leather
what we
pieces.
Want with the Soho Radio Health and Safety.
No, not at all. And it ruins the floor.
The blood the floor. Everywhere.
But yeah, so okay, we'll give it a go. We'll see what happens.
Okay, right. So I'm just like finding a sharp edge and then trying to kind of hit that sharp edge in such a way that
Yeah.
Go on, give it a crack. Oh, there you go. Oh, wow.
There
and
we
so
go.
Actually what's come off is kind of a flake. It's probably about a centimetre thick.
Yeah, it's quite a thick flake, but it has a sharp edge on it, and that's all you need. That is the earliest technology known to man, and that is all you need. You could quite easily butcher an entire elephant just with that single
flake.
Yeah,
it literally looks like a kind of spearhead already.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the edges on these things go down to less than an atom thick, so they are incredibly,
wow,
incredibly sharp.
So if you look at them under a microscope, they are atomically sharp.
Absolutely.
That is amazing.
Yeah, so there are some surgeons in the States that will occasionally use obsidian blades, so made in this exact same way, for operating on the eye.
That is amazing.
Because they're if you look at them under the microscope and you compare them to a surgical scalpel, they are considerably smoother.
Wow, that's, I mean, people even struggle now to make things that are atomically sharp.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
And they're brilliant. They don't, you know, they very rarely need resharpening. And if you know, that's a single flake, it took less than a
like
second to
hits.
Make. And you can get hundreds from a single piece of flint. So they're incredibly useful tools.
So that's me. It took you like a second to make. How long did it take you to actually learn how to do that?
Well, I mean, just making these very simple flakes, you can teach someone in you know, no time at all. When it gets to more complex technologies, so you start looking at the technologies that Homo erectus used, or the Neanderthals used, or early Homo sapiens used, that gets a lot more complicated, and there's a lot more different angles to it, basically.
Okay, well, it sounds quite easy, so I'm actually going to try and give it a go.
Yeah,
here,
absolutely.
And see what happens.
Me too. We're going to see who can get the better piece.
See who
of
can get a nice good flint. Yeah,
we're
going
to have a war.
Okay, so what's happened is that the flake that I've just taken off has produced this really nice flat surface on the flint core. And so if you strike with the hammerstone anywhere, probably about half a centimeter in from the edge, if you strike on the edge, it's just because the edges are so sharp, it's just going to crush the edge.
Yeah.
But if you strike about half a centimeter in from the edge, in a kind of a glancing blow, you should be able to get a flake from kind of the conjoining edge.
Brilliant. So we're gonna put some videos up of this,
yeah,
and so you can actually see what's happening. But for now, I'm just gonna try and give it a go.
Don't be afraid if you get flint everywhere, because it will shatter. So if you angle your right hand a little bit further down, there we go.
Okay, here we go.
There we are.
Oh.
Oh, well, fantastic noise.
That didn't work.
It did work. Something came off. It's on the floor.
Oh, I have a very, very small, very small flake.
Perfect for an arrowhead.
And it needs to be.
So, this is amazing. It's actually given me a nice sharp flint. It's rather smaller than yours.
It's small, but it's perfectly usable.
It's a beginner's tool. Matilda's going to town on the other sample we have right now.
Okay, so.
Currently to no avail.
What am I doing wrong?
Currently to no. It's not really working, is it?
If you hit it here.
Right, so
it's
very specific. You have to hit it in exactly the right place.
Yeah, if you just take two stones and you just smash them together, I mean, one of them might break. Because
I got a shard
about
the size of a pencil head.
One of them might break just because
of
the forces.
And that one was the size of a finger.
Yay!
Woo! Okay, I'm done.
So, this is amazing. There is a very specific technique to this. This is not something that just randomly happened, and this is how we know that these were intentional tool-making.
Yeah, so on, by and large, yes, that's exactly the situation. So up until very, very recently, what we have in the archaeological record are these flakes, and no other, you know, these don't happen naturally. You might get a rock falling from a cliff and you'll get one flake accidentally, you know, coming off with this conchoidal fracture. But conchoidal fracture is a mechanism that doesn't happen repeatedly naturally. And in the archaeological assemblages, in the archaeological record, we have literally thousands of these flakes. So they have to be made intentionally and produced intentionally.
So it's the density of these structures that don't happen that shows you that there's some sort of intent behind
it. Yeah, absolutely. And even in the earliest archaeological records, we have what we call use wear analysis, where people have looked and under the microscope at the edges of these flakes, and they can see that they've been used on various on meats or on organic material, wood, plant material, things like that. So we know that they've been used as well.
And I'm assuming there's other evidence from other remains where you actually see these tools being used on those remains.
Yeah, absolutely. So we also get, and that's the other kind of smoking gun, as it were, you also get lots of cut mark bones. So you get these fossil bones, and they're often of parts of the animal which are usually ignored by big game, so by lions and things. So they're on the leg, on the ends of the leg bones or on the feet. And you have these very characteristic cut marks on the fossils themselves that are made from the flint.
All right, so that's amazing. So starting off with these basic kind of flint flakes. What was the next step? What's the if we were gonna improve on the flints we've just made? What would we end up doing?
The next step and the next kind of.
I'd need to make some bigger ones.
Well, that's exactly the next step. That's exactly what happened was that the older ones, so this technology that lasted for a million years, then with the onset of Homo erectus or Homo ergaster, it's the same species, but Homo ergaster in Africa, they started to produce large flakes, big flakes, bigger than 10 centimetres. And from these, you have what's called a hand axe or a bifacially flaked tool, which is this, if you imagine it's like a teardrop shape, sharp, worked on all sides to produce a sharp cutting edge all the way around. And you also have a tool which I'm holding at the moment, which I made a few years back actually, which is called a cleaver, which is a very similar type of tool, but it has this flat, sharp cutting edge at the front, and often or sometimes you get even damage on the front. So it's been used as a chopping tool, basically.
It kind of looks like an axe head.
Yeah,
like a flat cutting surface, and then there's a kind of rounded back, but it's not mounted on anything.
It's not mounted. There's no evidence of them ever being hafted or mounted on anything. As far as we know, they were handheld objects, but these are the types of technology. Again, they lasted from about 1.7 for another million years or so, unchanged. So you have these huge periods of stasis, but it allowed Homo erectus and Homo ergaster to migrate out of Africa. This is the technology that kind of took them out of Africa and allowed them to penetrate into all regions of the world.
So this is like the first technological revolution that actually changed the way humans were living. It made them able to live in different places.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that you can produce a flake changed the way humans started living and how they interacted with the environment. I mean, there's no other animal on the planet that cuts things, basically. So that was the first one. And then this again expanded their reach and allowed them to, you know, really migrate out of Africa and into the world.
So that's amazing. So let's have your third song.
Okay, so the third song is not a song I would normally choose, but when I was doing my PhD, I was working in Olduvai, and we were living there basically in the middle of the Serengeti. And every now and again there will be a party, and it's an incredibly surreal moment where there's 30 or so scientists in the middle of the Serengeti at midnight dancing to Macklemore and Thrift Shop.
Can we go thrift shopping?
I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket.
Until recently, tool use was thought to be uniquely human. However, scientists have observed many animals using tools as well. Sea otters use rocks to break open shellfish. The burrowing wasp uses a pebble to hammer soil over its nest of eggs. And green herons use bait to attract fish.
Well, that's pretty amazing. So actually, this is something that you've been working on. You've been looking at how primates are using tools as a way of understanding how early humans or early hominids actually used tools.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is me kind of diverging away from East Africa and early humans. And so the last year I've been working with the Primate Archaeology Group, which is looking at basically the archaeology of primates. I mean, it's doing the same kind of things that we do for early humans, because primates use stone tools and they therefore leave an archaeological record that we can kind of see and we can trace into the past. So, yeah, we have at the moment, currently there are three tool-using primates, stone tool-using primates. There are a number of tool-using primates, but you have the chimpanzees in West Africa that use stone hammers and anvils to crack nuts. And you have capuchins in Brazil, and they use stone tools for a whole wide variety of different things, including cracking nuts. They'll use them for digging in an area called Sierra de Capivara National Park in northeast Brazil. So they'll dig for spiders and they'll dig for the small roots. They'll use them for sexual displays. So the females will throw the stones at the males to get their attention, which I wouldn't recommend particularly for anybody.
Yeah, that might not work.
No. And then they also use them for various other percussive behaviours. So they'll hit things with them. And then you also have macaques, long-tailed macaques in Thailand, which use stone hammerstones from the beach, stone cobbles, to open oysters and open seashells.
Okay, so how did these tools actually... how are they different from the tools that you find with early hominids?
So in general, they are restricted to what we call kind of percussive behaviors. So where you're taking a hammer stone and you're trying to open a hard-to-reach food, basically. In the archaeological record, in the early human record, we find fragmented bones and bones with what we call spiral fractures on them, which have been used, which have been opened using a hammer stone to get at the bone marrow. So there's this incredibly nutritious bone marrow inside these bones. You also find what we call anvils, which are these large blocks which seem to have a lot of battering and a lot of percussive marks on them. So there's an interesting analogy between what we find in the archaeological record, in the human archaeological record, and what these chimpanzees and what the macaques and the capuchins are doing. So they're doing a very similar type of behavior, and so that makes them kind of uniquely valuable in looking at the behaviors that our ancestors might
and
have
they
done.
Do this in the same area. They use the same anvil stone, they use same hammer stones, or is it just kind of they just pick up something wherever?
So they don't do them in the same area as the early humans. The early humans are in East Africa, and these guys are all over the world. But they will have specific places where they will do this behavior in their environment. So the chimpanzees, for instance, will gather around the ones on the Ivory Coast, in the Thai forest, in Thai. They will gather around panda trees. These are panda nut trees, and these are quite rare in the forest. So when there's one there, you'll have groups of chimpanzees or individuals of chimpanzees gathering around this tree, picking up nuts, and then using wooden anvils, so roots, for instance, and then using a really large hammer stone, and they're cracking open these nuts. In Bosu, in the forest in Guinea, you have chimps that use stone anvils. So these are a lot more, the ones in Guinea are a lot more similar to the hominin archaeological record that we find.
So they're not fashioning tools. They're not fashioning tools in the same way that early humans are, but they are using these to strike and open things that they would otherwise not be able to eat.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the stone tools. They're not fashioning stone tools. They do fashion tools. I mean, the chimpanzees, we all know the chimpanzees do termite fishing, and they will take them. They're fashioning those termite fishing sticks. So they will take a stick and they will strip it of the leaves and they will strip it occasionally of the bark, and they will fashion it. So they're making a tool, and that's a really interesting behaviour. But in terms of the stone tools, the problem is with the wooden tools, they don't preserve in the archaeological record, so we can't trace them back into time. But with the stone tools, we can.
So what kind of times are you looking at for these? Is this thousands of years ago, millions of years ago, or
yeah? In terms of kind of human evolution times, it's not that much. But for chimpanzee excavations, and there hasn't been many. There's only really been one. Or two chimpanzee excavations done in 2002 and 2007, and the date that they have for that is about 4,000 years, just over 4,000 years. So, I mean, in terms of chimpanzee archaeology, that's a really long time. That's several generations of individuals.
Yeah, yeah.
And the work that we've been doing at Oxford, we've done the same thing for capuchins in Brazil, and we found that their use of stone tool dates back at least 700 years could go back further.
Okay, that's me. So it's not the same timescale, but this is something that they're passing on to the next generation, and it's being sustained for a very long period of time.
Absolutely. And in Brazil with the Capuchins, one of the theories was that these Capuchins learned how to use stone tools for nutcracking, for instance, from humans in the area. From that. But it looks like, you know, it's probably not. It's probably a behavior that is learnt within the Capuchins themselves.
Did you find evidence of the stone tool use kind of before prior
to the occupation of humans in that area, in that specific area?
Okay, so it's something that's come about independently.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Capuchins are very interesting at the moment. We've just had a paper published recently that we're looking at a specific behaviour with the Capuchins, where they take one hammer stone and they'll strike another stone, and from this what they're doing is they'll accidentally produce flakes, just because the raw material is the same as what we find in East Africa, and the motions that they're doing will unintentionally produce these sharp flakes that we normally associate with hominin material.
The kind of stuff that we are...
The kind of stuff that you just made. Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. So actually we're learning a lot about how these tools first came about
Absolutely. It's really interesting to kind of think about how this technology emerged, because what we find in the archaeological record is that this technology seems to just appear. There's no lead-up, there's no gradual evolution of this. It just appears all of a sudden. And it seems to be fully formed and a really complex, relatively complex technology just sitting there. So there has to be a period before that where whether it, you know, whether it was a gradual evolution or whether it was a sudden change, but there was a period before that where it, you know, emerged. And so looking at primates who produce material that's very similar to this, we can start to get an interesting idea about, you know, the level of cognitive complexity, how intelligent you have to be to make it, how advanced your hands have to be in order to make this. I mean, what type of behaviours are also associated with the emergence of stone tool technology.
That's amazing. So let's move on to your fourth song.
Okay, so the fourth song. So as an archaeologist, I quite like songs that are essentially kind of like archaeological songs. So songs which were made or written in the past and are relevant to the past, but kind of give you a nice little insight into life before now. So this is Nick Jones, and it's about a whaling boat, I think, and his little pot stove.
Where the winter blizzards blow and the whaling fleets at rest, tacked in Leith harbors sheltered by, safely anchored ten abreast. Well, there's the whalemen at their stations, as from ship to ship they row, carry bags of coal with them and a little iron stove.
Indian bottlenose dolphins in Shark Bay, Australia, are the first known marine mammals to use tools. They hold sponges in their beaks to stir the ocean bottom sand and uncover prey, and spend more time hunting with tools than any animal besides humans.
News. Highest vascular plant ever found in the Himalaya.
Buff upper arms let Lucy climb trees.
The entire internet will be archived in Canada to protect it from Trump.
Honeycombs can stop jams. In traffic, that is.
And NASA is offering $30,000 to whoever can invent a better space nappy that lasts for 6 days.
Well, I think we're going to have to start with that last one. a new space nappy, that's amazing.
Yeah, so at the moment, astronauts will wear space nappies when they are taking kind of long spacewalks, but it'll never be for like more than, say, 8 hours maximum, I think. And so it only ever has to collect urine. But as they start looking at trips to go all the way out to Mars and things, like at the moment, if something was to go wrong, they're fairly close to Earth. And they can come back to Earth or get help from the space station. They never have to wait too long. But if they were on the way to Mars and something went wrong, and they might have to, you know, rely on spacesuits to survive until they can fix a problem.
Right.
NASA
okay.
is predicting they're gonna need nappies that could last 6 days, and so they're very exacting about it. They want they've released a kind of advert, a crowdsourcing space poop challenge.
Great, of course,
so
they have
on a platform called HeroX. If you can submit your proposal before the 20th of December, the winner will get this $30,000. And they want something that will safely collect and store a litre of urine, 75 millilitres of fecal matter, and just over 13 millilitres of menstrual blood for 6 days.
Wow.
And that's per day.
That's really specific. That's really specific. Oh, that's amazing. So, Lucy was buff.
This is a
which Lucy are you talking about?
Yeah, so
this is Australopithecus afarensis. This is a story that came out a couple of days ago, I think. And I've just done some new CT scans. This is a hominin. It's about 3.5 foot tall, around between 3 and 4 million years ago.
And Lucy
Lucy is an individual.
Individual.
It's one of the most complete skeletons of the species that we have, and it is pre-Homo. So it's pre-Homo lineage. So it's an Australopithecus. And it's one of the first bipedal apes that we see, one of the first bipedal hominins.
Right, okay.
And recently there's been a couple of stories coming out about Lucy. And this one is talking about, they've done some new CT scans of the upper arms of this specimen, and they found that they're incredibly robust, incredibly thick, basically. And they cluster, or they're very similar to the types of arms, the type of arm structure, bone structure that you have with chimpanzees.
Oh, right.
So they suggest that it spent a lot of its time climbing, although it has incredibly human-like feet and bipedal feet. So it's also walking a lot, but they argue that it was nesting in the trees or it was climbing around and foraging in the trees.
I guess it's a bit safer up there, because this was around the time when it still wasn't the apex predator.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's a 3.5-foot walking around, you know, little hominin. Like a hobbit. I mean, and
a
it comes
that climbs trees.
It comes across a lion, and it's, you know, it's screwed, basically.
Yeah, I mean, these tools can only take you so far, right?
I mean, at this point, there's no evidence that these species were making tools either.
So this is
even before that. So this is a hominin species that was walking around collecting fruit, for instance, and that kind of doing very similar things to what chimpanzees do.
Okay, amazing. So I found some stuff about the highest ever plant found in the Himalayas. So this is amazing. So this is saying the highest vascular plant. So this is a plant that's like a flower or a tree, you know.
And got water going through it.
Yeah, it's not like moss or lichen, that sort of thing. And so this guy, Jiří Dolezal from Czech Academy of Science, and Roy Angel from University of Vienna, they found a number of these cushion plants growing at 6,150 meters above sea level, which is a record for these kind of plants. Now, some of this is amazing because it was actually so high that it's very difficult for them to work continuously up there. They had to only work in short bursts because it's at that level the oxygen's very low.
Say work, do you mean like photosynthesis?
As in the humans going up there to find the plant.
Oh, okay.
That's how high it is.
So it's amazing for the humans, but not for the plants.
Well, so this is the first time that these plants have been found that high, which is pretty amazing, but it's also indicative of something a bit scary, which is that this area has been subject to deglaciation, and actually the temperatures there have risen by 6 degrees in the last decade.
Oh my god, that's loads.
And so that's a lot.
Yeah.
And this is obviously because of climate change. And these parts of the planet, the high mountain glaciers and the poles are very susceptible to these kind of temperature changes. And so we're just really starting to see these very drastic changes due to climate change, which is quite scary. But
yeah, absolutely.
And what's your honeycomb? I mean, the best pun of all the titles.
Honeycombs can stop jams in traffic, that is. So this is some kind of theoretical work which was done at the University of Columbia on how traffic jams form. And what they did is they modelled a grid system of like a city, like we'd normally have, you know, streets running north, south, east, west, and tried to put traffic kind of propagating through that. And they found that what happens is, as the density of traffic increases, it gets to a point where there's just no movement of traffic. There's like this sudden shutdown, everything goes into quite literally gridlock. And so they designed different roads, one which are based on honeycombs, so you can actually move, you know, in 6 different directions at every junction. And what they found is when they increased the density of traffic, there was a very slow transition from moving traffic to stationary traffic. So there's not this kind of critical mass where suddenly everything stops. It's like more of this kind of loose, you know, soft transition. So this is
we need to design our cities like hives.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously it's going to be quite difficult to redesign an entire city in this way, but it's quite useful for other forms of traffic like internet and different ways of communicating.
Yeah,
so this hopefully should give some more insights into that. Okay. And so Matilda, you were saying the entire internet is going to go to Canada?
Yeah, this story amazed me just because I didn't even realise that there was like a backup internet. That was a thing, that there is an internet archive of every web page that's ever been created. So it's a company called the Internet Archive. It's a US non-profit, and it's been archiving the web for 20 years, and they are really worried about Trump coming in and having new US censorship laws that might affect their archive. So they are planning to migrate it to Canada, although that's going to cost them a lot of money, and currently they're trying to get fundraising and donations. So I don't
think amazing.
Canada was expecting a Trump refugee of the entire internet.
The entire internet. Okay, great, Tom. So we're going to move on to your next song.
Okay, so the next song, just because it has to be in there, is anything by Bob Dylan. But also I heard I always hear the Jimi Hendrix version of this song, and every time I hear it, I like it. But I always think I kind of want to hear the Bob Dylan version as well. So this is All Along the Watchtower.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine. Plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth.
The Corvid family, crows and their relatives, have been dubbed the feathered apes because their tool use rivals that of primates. The very best are the New Caledonian crows, the only birds known to craft tools in the wild. And recently, they've been shown to use three tools in succession to reach food. Some string to reach a short stick, the short stick to reach a long stick, and the long stick to reach the food.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So we're going to head back to our brain teaser that we had at the top of the show, something that actually stumped me. A tool many of us use every day. I have keys but no locks. I have space but no room. You can enter, but can't go outside. What am I? I don't know. I'm thinking, like, keys, maybe, like, piano keys, or something like that. Space, but no room. No.
We've had one person suggesting, is it the heart? I guess they're thinking, like, keys to your heart, and your heart... You can come into someone's heart, but it doesn't really have an inside.
Oh, yeah.
Any ideas?
Oh, I like that.
I was thinking a map, but I think that's probably way, way off. And the only really... The keys was the... Was the way I was thinking.
I think a map works. A map kind of works. Yeah. It's got a key in the bottom right hand corner, right?
I was drawing a blank. Thinking like very well along the right lines, quite abstract. It is a keyboard.
Of course it is. Keyboard.
Yeah, the enter key and the space key.
Of course.
Keys.
Oh dear. Right. Well, so that stumped me, but I'm glad that none of us got it. Anyway, one thing I'm fascinated about with this idea of human tools is. Did tools affect humans? Did it affect the evolution? Or did we just have to wait to evolve to get to a level where suddenly we can then use tools?
So this is a huge question. This is a question that, you know, people that are far more intelligent than me have been working on for many years. It's a really difficult question to answer because the argument goes that you need a certain level of kind of manual dexterity or a certain type of hand anatomy before you can kind of sufficiently... apply the forces that are needed to make tools, but then as soon as you make tools, it has a feedback loop basically. So if you're accessing high quality meat that's only available because you can make sharp cutting tools, that decreases the amount of time that your body needs to spend on digestion and increases the amount of energy that your brain gets. And so as your brain gets bigger, basically it increases your cognitive abilities and you make better tools, and it's a big feedback loop. So how and when stone tools were first used is a huge question, but then as soon as they were being made, it undoubtedly must have had a massive effect on our evolution and then continuing our development.
So that's amazing. I like this idea of this feedback loop and that maybe the technology that we're using now is so much more advanced that could be changing us again in ways that we don't even know yet.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I mean, the internet, for instance, changed absolutely everything. I mean, before that, you know, you could hardly reach, it was really difficult to reach hundreds of people, but the internet and with mobile phones and things, you can reach thousands of people really easily, which is something that's never been able to happen on the planet before.
And we are reaching thousands of people right now. And if you want to listen again to any of the shows on Science Mixtape, you can go onto iTunes and download a podcast. And we do it again on any other way that you can get hold of the show, be that Stitcher or all of the rest of them. So thank you, Thomas, so much.
No problem.
For joining us. And so I've been Kyle, and we've got Matilda sat behind the desk. And we're going to finish with your final song.
Okay, so my final song is... when I was growing up in South Wales, my friends there had a band, and they've been through a number of reiterations, but at the moment, they're not hugely big, but they're big getting bigger in South Wales. And I listen to them when I'm writing, just because it's rock music, and I go back and I quite like rock music. So this is Beautiful Strangers and a song called Domino.